Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 12 with Irish breeder Andrew Hughes. Andrew and his brother Niall run Ennisnag Stud in County Kilkenny. In the past 10 to 15 years, they've quickly developed to become one of Ireland's leading producers of young show jumpers. And in recent seasons, they've also added a stallion wing to their business. And in this episode, Andrew also announces an exciting new addition to the stallion roster at Ennisnag Stud. You've been born into one of Ireland's most prominent equestrian families. Who has been your greatest teacher within your family, and who has been your greatest influence outside of your family?
Outside of my immediate family, or
unrelated.
Right. Well, naturally, my father and mother are the biggest influences on everything in life and in everything. Like everybody's parents are, but especially with the horses, because Dad rode all the horses for Seamus, and like Seamus had he was possibly the best judge of a horse I've ever known. And Dad and Seamus worked together that way. Seamus had all the horses and Dad rode them until Marion came along. So that's what, I suppose, formed my interest in horses. And my dad was a vet, so my mother's job then was to cart us to every show that ever was in pony clubs, and she nurtured it that way, if you know what I mean. So it was a dual effort. But definitely, I ring my father every night and I talk to him about horses. So he's definitely the biggest influence in my family. But I was lucky. There are so many influential people in it and that have had little bits. My Uncle John, a vet and stud cavalier. My Uncle Seamus, should still be around and having an influence on it. Marion, Tom Brennan, like it's just
that's what I was thinking.
It's a fantastic.
Between immediate first cousins, between yourself, Niall, Tom, Tim, John, between John and Tim, you have two vets. Between your uncles and your father, you have another at least two vets. Yeah. Marion
and Claire, Marie's youngest is a vet, or oldest is a vet. And then like Claire has a fantastic facility up there as well, and I have horses with her, and like, so it's, and we were always together as kids, like we, because of pony clubs and because of that generation that it was in,
and location,
right beside each other. So we were rare together from the time we were whatever, and like myself, Tom and Marion are in the same age bracket, if you know what I mean. So we would have spent a lot of time on ponies and stuff like that. So
is there much competition between you?
Of course there is, but friendly competition. I'd be jumping out of the seat if Tom or Marion had something jumping somewhere, if they were in a final or Claire or whatever. But yeah, of course there is.
And that's what's nice as well, is that, and you've said it before, but like if you have horses, you'll be down to Marion's schooling, or Brendan Doyle will be giving you a hand if, you know, if there's something getting ready for the sales, and like it's a huge asset.
Yeah, we intertwine a lot, and they're fantastic. Marion's fantastic with her facilities, and Claire the same. Like, you just, all you have to do is ring and ask and away you go, you know, and they help each other out. And look, at if I can help them with something on, like, I've been involved in the breeding industry for a long time. If there was a sick foal, or if there was something like that they wanted me to look at, or if there was a mare foaling and they were having problems or something like that, they'd give me a ring. And so it works every way, so it's good.
Do you think there's any added pressure of being born into the family that you're born into?
No.
In the horse world?
Well, I don't feel any pressure, no.
Because that's what you'd wonder, would you be... Yeah, like, would you feel a weight of expectations because of the success of the previous generations?
No, I enjoy it too much. It's actually my hobby as well as my
work. So I don't actually feel any pressure with it.
Because it, I suppose that maybe it's the difference between a family business versus a family passion, because there's probably a lot of successful entrepreneurs whose kids would go the opposite direction to the space that they are in. But what's amazing is how many of you have gone at it either full time or it's completely consumed their out of hour activities.
You know, my father was a vet, so we had no, like, we had, dad had trade in an odd horse, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And then he kept one mare, which was the sister, full sister to Diamond Exchange. And that's the first broodmare that we ever had. And then she's kind of the foundation of what I, if I had a favourite mare, like, that line is my favourite line because it's been with us all our life. And it was the first one that started us in the business of breeding, if you know what I mean. Before that, mm-hmm. we had no history of breeding. Seamus did all the breeding, and my grandfather Thomas was the, you know, Tom Hughes was the breeder in the whole package. Yeah. So
from your time managing Ballylinch Stud and currently running Thistle Bloodstock, are there specific learnings from the thoroughbred world that you feel you've carried through into the sport horse world?
Yeah, definitely the professionalism. Like, there isn't a foal born on the place that I'm not at the foaling, which is a start, if you know what I mean. A lot of people, sure, I had a foal last night, I don't know when I was born, but I had a foal last night, whereas everything, like, we have cameras, we have that I watch 24/7, we have foaling alarms, mm-hmm. we bring in a night man if there's more than one kind of dew or whatever, we bring in a night man. So it's the professionalism, time management, organization. I'm very punctual. I like to be very organized. Mm-hmm. I make my mating plans now for next year. I make my if I'm planning to go somewhere, I plan it well in advance and things like that. So I think there was an element of that professionalism
when you're doing from the thoroughbred world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And how do you see much difference between the types of breeders that you would have been dealing with, say, when you're managing Ballylinch versus the breeders that you're dealing with now?
Well, last year was the first year that we stood stallions, so that would be my, last year would have been the first interaction I would have had with breeders on a commercial level, mm-hmm. as such, besides buying something off someone or something like that. And I must say, the condition of everything that came in and how they were done, and how they were done as in set up reproductively, was top class.
Great.
I must say, and I was pleasantly surprised in, on that front. So not much of a difference. No, the people are getting more and more professional about it now, so
that's positive.
Yeah.
How would you describe your current business model in a snag stud?
Describe my business model. I have everything, something for everyone.
Well, I suppose not necessarily just the product offering, but when you're setting out to breed your particular mares, what's the kind of the breeding goal, and what's the plan of action with those young horses? I know the plan has to change depending on the horse, but what's the overall plan or business model with the sport horses?
The breeding plan is pretty simple. I get the best pedigree that I can possibly get, and then they have to jump. Now, to me, they have to jump as a 3-year-old, not loose jumping, lunging, or mm-hmm. loose jumping, and they have to show ability to get into the breeding program.
Yeah.
Okay. It's too long a process to put them in breeding or to put them in training, and then bring them back to be broodmares. They've wasted too much of their life for me.
Yeah.
So therefore, every mare that I have is there for a jumper with a pedigree. So all I really need to do is improve their model to make them a pretty jumper with a pedigree. And that is the breeding goal, is to improve the model of the offspring to make them more modern to suit the market that's out there at the moment. And basically that's been the goal the whole time.
And then with your young horses, like, you're not someone who's deliberately aiming to sell foals, you're not someone who's deliberately aiming to sell 3-year-olds.
I don't send anything to public auction at any stage. And I like, my goal is to breed the show jumper and to go sell them at 7-8, that sort of time. Now, if somebody comes into the yard and sees a foal or a yearling or a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old and wants to buy it, it's for sale. But my thing is to go to 3, jump them at 3. Everything that I think is good enough to go on further is then either kept myself, or I sell a half share in it, or I do something along that lines, but I keep it and go on. And then the ones that aren't good enough, and ones that aren't good enough are usually good enough for other
jobs.
I sell those at 3 then. So that's my...
Even just with the ones that you decide, well, when you're assessing them all, and then with the ones you decide you're keeping, what has that whole assessment process looked like, kind of start to finish? When do you start assessing them? What are you assessing them on or for? And then what do they have to do to convince you that they deserve to stay?
As soon as they're born, you start assessing them, really, from a physical point of view.
Yeah.
And from a mental point of view and an attitude point of view and everything like that. But really, it's when they jump a pole and whether they're good enough that you think they have a potential to jump 140 plus. Because if they have the potential to jump 140 plus, then they're worth spending money on to produce. So that's basically...
Because I suppose when you're making that decision, it's not just are they worth to produce as a 4-year-old, you're thinking are they worth to produce from 3 to 7, or...
They have to go to 7, and they have to be able to kind of jump the 140 tracks, whether either a professional or an amateur. And to get that to that stage, that's what you have to get to get enough money for them, you know, to vindicate it, because it is expensive.
Roughly, when you average it out, what do you think that it costs to get that horse from the broken 3-year-old to the 7-year-old? Even without going off to international shows, even just producing them on a national level, or your annual cost per young horse.
The young horses are easy enough valuate. You can kind of put them in at about €10 a day, which is about 3,500 a year. That's without any major problem, as in veterinary problem or anything like that. The older horses are different. I don't plan to go for the 4-year-old stage. So the 4-year-old and 5-year-olds stage is relatively inexpensive. But then once they get to 6, I put them into training, take them out, put them in, take them out, put them in, take them out. And then once you get to 6, 7, then it becomes quite expensive. And then it depends on where you go and what shows you go to and whether you go abroad or not, you know.
Do you have, I'm not getting into what each individual horse is worth, but do you, when you're looking at that 3-year-old, do you need to make a decision that it has to be worth X, a minimum of a particular price point at that 6, 7-year-old age before you even start?
You'd have to be hoping that it'd be worth £100,000 plus to go through all the hardship to get to that stage, you know, from breeding it. And they've got to pay for the ones that aren't good enough.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing to factor in your case, like you said, with when you approach the different riders, is if at 3 the majority of them you've given a half share to for the production costs, then there's 2 people need to be paid at the end of that as well, which puts added pressure on itself.
It doesn't, but it means somebody else is believing in your judgment too, though.
And you have to be tougher. Both of you have to be tougher on that judgment, because nobody wants to waste their time.
It's about making money at that stage. Mm. Yeah,
that's probably very helpful, because there's kind of no room for the ifs and buts, or sure, we'll chance it on for a few years because it's a commercial enterprise.
There's no sentimentality in it, without a doubt. You have to be ruthless, and you're better off at times to get a small profit and move on rather than going further and further, and then the next thing you're into a loss, you know.
Yeah. With your breeder rider partnerships, what do you think the kind of keys to success are with those, and then how much of that partnership would be put down in paper? And I'll throw a third thing in now. How do you decide on which rider to approach with which horse? What does that process look like? So I suppose, how do you pick your riders? What do you think the keys are to that partnership being a success? And how much of that do you put down on paper versus just a verbal agreement?
Different situations with different people. Myself and Cian have had a partnership for a long number of years with mares, and Cian O'Connor, with mares and things like that. And that agreement was initially done on paper, but it's the same agreement going through. So we don't write down an agreement. We come to a conclusion what we're going to keep, what we're going to sell, and then we have an initial agreement that was put in place 10 years ago. About 10 years ago, anyway. And we work it that way. The other ones are done on paper, and if it's a filly, I always put in that I have first refusal on it to bring it back into the breeding brand at a certain price if it gets injured or anything like that. And but there is a contract done. It's pretty simple. It's not rocket science, but it's there. It's just mainly, I think the biggest thing is when to sell and when not to sell. If one wants to sell and one doesn't, I think that's the one issue that can become an issue.
That, and then at that point, one has to buy the other one out.
Correct. Yeah. So if one wants to sell at a price, then the other person has the option of buying them out. And that's the one issue that I thought would be, oh, I'd like to sell it. No, I don't want to sell it. You're not selling it. And that sort of way. So.
And are there one or two other things that you see reoccurring? Because some breeders recently have asked about breeder-rider partnerships and even how to go about forming that, or what are the key things to put down?
I think the key thing to put down is the longevity of the thing. Like, if you go to someone and do that agreement, and the next thing I take the horse out this week and I have it 2 weeks, and I go to a show and somebody comes up and offers me 30,000 for the horse, and now the rider has it 2 weeks and I want to sell it for, and I get 15,000 and you get 15,000, that isn't going to work.
Yeah.
So you've got to put in that if it's sold in the first whatever
6 months or whatever,
6 months, it's, you get X percentage, rather than if it's over a certain price. And yeah, look, there's a lot of little things,
variables,
that you get variables in there. And I'm not saying any of the riders are trying to make a quick buck. They could possibly say, look, this is probably the value of the horse in 2 years' time, we should take it now, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
I'm
and
not
that's
saying,
helpful as well.
I'm not saying that,
yeah,
but
to try to be fair to both
to
sides.
To be fair to both sides. If you're after putting all the work in and all the money in, and then they have it for 3 weeks, and then the first show they
flip,
go to,
they
flip it and they get half it, you could feel a little gutted, I suppose.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest issue. Everything else, but it can work the other way too. They can have it for 7 years. And the next thing, their end is way outweighing your end. So, you know.
And you probably have to sit down and readjust that in that case to take the cost out.
Because
if the agreement is to split profit, then that's very different than to split the purchase, to split the purchase price.
I've never had a row with any of them yet.
Yeah.
I've never had a serious, we've had our differences of opinion, but I've never had a falling out row with any of them yet, so. It's worked pretty okay, but I've picked people of good character, so and that's important.
And do you find it difficult when you have your kind of we call them your first draft of 3-year-olds or your top picks, do you find it difficult to decide which riders you're going to with which horses? Or like, do you have a clear idea that that's a horse for X, Y, and Z? Or
yeah, and I keep some of them myself, wholly and solely, so okay. they don't go to. I don't have to make that decision, so they go, and they're just put into training, and I pay the fees like anybody else would.
Okay.
There is a number of them. There is a number then that people are very interested in, and they want to buy a share in them, and there is some of those which are pure 50-50 share deals,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. And then there's others that we come to an agreement, okay, look, I think this horse is a really nice horse, I really love this horse, can I will do something, and we sit down and we trash it out. So I've done every different deal that there's possible, I think, at this stage. So it's a combination. It depends on the horse, and it depends on who's coming in with you and things like that. So
when you initially set out to build up the broodmare herd, I'd say probably 90%+ of what you've added has been bought as a foal. When you're setting out to find those filly foals to add to your program, now you've mentioned this, you've discussed this before, but you might just go through it for the benefit of anyone that hasn't heard it. Why do you go for filly foals specifically, and then with those filly foals, what are the essential elements that they have to bring to the table, and your kind of non-negotiables around that?
Okay, when I set out first, I had time on my side because I have a business that was paying the bills, a thoroughbred business. So it was a hobby with a plan to turn it into a business,
mm-hmm.
over time. But I knew it would take 10 to 12 years to actually come to fruition.
Yeah.
So I started out, I said, right, if I buy a mare, she's probably had 3 or 4 foals. If somebody's selling her, is she good enough? Are the offspring good enough? I don't know. So I'm not saying they were or they weren't, but I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
If they're 3-year-olds and stuff like that, they can be set up for you. You can get a different product home than you actually saw. And I said, nobody can manipulate a foal as such. So I then decided that I was going to buy filly foals, which were also at the time, 10 or 12 years ago, a lot cheaper than colts, because the German, French, Belgium, Dutch were very stallion orientated. So the stallion foals were making a lot more than the fillies. It's kind of flipped now.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out to the continent. I researched the pedigrees and tried to get everything with 160 up, as high up the page as I can on a pedigree page. And that was the criteria. And then I would take them home, I would keep them till they're 3, and I would jump them. And no matter what their pedigree was like,
or how much they cost,
if they couldn't jump, they were sold. Because I subconsciously couldn't look at them for the rest of their lives if I knew they weren't good enough. Like when I go out in the field and I don't like something, it actually drives me mad,
yeah.
just looking at it. So I couldn't breed off it. It's just something in my psyche that I couldn't breed off it if it wasn't good enough itself. And I couldn't keep it. So I sold all those. So anything that I have was a very good jumper as a 3-year-old.
And had you specific criteria within the type then? Or is there anything that you just won't forgive? Like you might love the pedigree, you go to see the filly, and are there specific things confirmationally or otherwise that are just complete non-runners for you?
Slightly crooked turned out wouldn't really bother me, but it has to have blood in a step and be athletic. It has to be an athlete, because if it's not an athlete, like it invariably won't jump. But you have the odd one that does, but invariably it won't as a rule. So,
and with the ones that you have bought, raised, and like enough to breed from, have you gone on to produce any of those, or have they all gone straight into breeding? Have you decided to produce any of those fillies that you've bought through?
No, none. I, they're That's why I buy them, to breed off them. So none of them have been produced. None of them have gone. I break them now because I didn't to start with, and then they become
unruly.
No, more not their fault, my fault. Because they become, you're trying to bring them into the stocks then, and they push through you rather than stand there and things like that. So everything gets broken now, but I don't put them on their saddle. I just do it now. I have a couple of mares from lines that I have. I have put into. I have a very good mare with Damien Griffin, China Girl. She competed in all the six-year-old classes this year, and but I have that line now, so I will sell the fillies. I don't keep every filly. I work it out that I get rid of the bottom 10% every year. Mm-hmm. So 2 to 3 mares every year get sold, okay, and that's my way of keeping the quality up. Because if I think I'm adding something better than those two, and then I've made mistakes, I've sold a mare which the next progeny turned out very good, and I've gone back and I bought the foal. But I rang the guy and told him, I said, I think you got a deal here, this horse is very good, keep me in mind for any offspring that are for sale, I would be interested. And I actually went back and bought the first foal off him this year, so it works both ways.
And it is good, I guess. The 10% culling policy, I don't think we touched on it yet, but you run from around 20 to 25. So yeah, you've 2 or 3 going on any given year. What are the things that get a mare into the bottom 10%?
Our offspring. I jump the offspring, and when I have 2 or 3 jump, then they're eligible for expulsion at that stage.
But it is great, because like the mare that you might start with, and it's something that I've even seen at home, just because a mare was good enough for your program 5 years ago, just because she was good enough last month, doesn't mean that she's still good enough or relevant. And there's someone else can be perfectly happy with them, and they're perfectly good enough for another breeding program, but they just don't match your plan anymore. And I think it's something that I see a lot. There seems to be this struggle that breeders have, that they feel that they're doing some sort of like disservice to the mare, but really all they're doing is harming themselves. Because whether they come to feed the mare in the morning or someone else does, the mare's probably not overly worried. So if she's not fitting your plan and she's going off somewhere and she can live a good life somewhere else, people need to just embrace that.
It's not so much the mare. The next thing, you have 7 offspring of the mare, and you have to get rid of them. And if it was difficult to get rid of the first 3, the chances are the next 4 are going to be equally as difficult to get rid of, or more.
Yeah. Is there an ideal number or a sweet spot in terms of the size of a broodmare herd to make it commercially viable? Like, you've stayed fairly consistently around your broodmare numbers over the last few years. Do you think, I suppose, is that deliberate? Is it based on facilities, land, or was that the amount that you felt was necessary to get the number of good horses coming through each year that you needed?
I think everything. You've just answered my question. It's definitely, I think I found that of the 25 mares, every 3-year-old bunch that I jump, it's a different bunch of mares that are producing them. But I'm not saying she can produce year 1, 3, 4, 5, 7, and this one can produce 2, 4. You know, it's different mares that are producing the ones that I'm keeping. But it's the one that's the most consistent is the one that you really want. The one that produces 1, 2, 3 misses a year there. 2, you know, she has 5 out of 10, and another one has 3 out of 10. Another one has 7 out of 10. If you know what I mean. So it's the one that consistently produces. But it's different years they produce them. That's why I don't do embryo transfers or ICSI or anything like that, because then you end up with 20 of the one mare.
And another 20 recipients.
Yeah.
From around the field.
Which I couldn't look at. So therefore, I like the way I do it. I like the variety.
And did you, when you were setting out, did you have a target number of mares? Or did you just get to this point and go, okay, we can manage this, but any more is...
No, I got to this point and then said, that's enough. And my wife probably said, that's enough too.
I have to
wonder. Yeah. So, no, it just got to a number. I think 20 was kind of a number. I'm at 25 now. So I think that's 25 is the correct number.
From starting out in your breeding program to now, what do you feel have been the major challenges in establishing your breeding program?
Finding the mares was a big challenge, as in I wouldn't buy anything without seeing it, so I like to go see them. And when you have an auction on or a private sale, it's to try and organize. We're very busy, like to run over 100 horses in a complex like this, it's quite time consuming. So it was hard to get time to go, and it's easy enough to research them because you can sit down at night there and be on a computer and doing it. But when you have to go jump on a plane, I go away for 2 days. It takes me 3 days to catch up when I come back, if you know what I mean. So it's hard to take that time. Time is your own time to go and do these things and do it properly.
And I guess if you've gone, say even if we go 25 mares, and you've gone to view all of those and buy all of those, well, you've probably looked at four or five times and more than that to get the filly that you want. And that's a lot of trips and a lot of driving on a trip bar.
Yeah, we went to Belgium a couple of weeks ago, myself and Niall, and we flew in Friday morning 6 o'clock, flew home Sunday night at 9:30, and we put 1,000 kilometers on the car. So that shows you the amount of miles we covered for a 2 day trip, if you know what I mean. Saw a lot of nice horses, but it was a 2 day trip and 1,000 kilometers. So fair going. We didn't have much hanging around.
Yeah. What was the main motivation for starting the stallion branch of Enniskanaghy Stud?
It was always the plan. The one thing I always said, people were always wanted stallions, because stallions, a proper stallion, Emerald or one of these, generate millions of euros per annum. And that's what the ideal, everybody wants. But my philosophy is that you need the mare to produce the stallion.
Yeah.
So a mare will produce the stallion. So that was always the plan. It was the plan from the very beginning, but it was to breed our own, as well as incorporate others into the, buy in a stallion if it was good enough and things like that. But to build it up, we had to wait and start producing our own. And now I have 6 stallions going forward for approval in March. So therefore we left those, we didn't castrate those 3 years ago. So it's kind of, and we have a couple of 4-year-old stallions as well coming forward. So it's kind of 5 years ago we decided that, okay, we now have the mares that we want. Okay, we'll always add one or two in, hopefully self-bred. But if one comes on the market that we're excited about and we can afford, then we will add it to the broodmare band. And now we will leave them as stallions, and we will pick out the nice physical models that basically, as a rule of thumb, would you use it yourself? Like, would I send a mare to that horse? If yes, we leave it as a stallion till it's 3 and we jump it, and we see then if it's good enough to jump, we'll go to the approvals and see if they agree with us.
Yeah. And because, I suppose on the pedigree side of those colts, because you're so critical on what mares come in and what mares stay, the pedigree element of the horse is already
taken care of,
sorted.
Yeah.
Do you see any disadvantages or extra challenges being a breeder owning stallions?
See an advantage because I can use the I only will stand stallions that I would use myself, whether I get one in or whether I produce it. And I have no, I don't, everyone looks at their own horses through rose tinted glasses, and they can say what they want, but they do, and I do too. Don't worry, all my horses are better than they probably are in the general public sense. But to my eye, it has to be financial too, so therefore I'm not going to shoot myself in the pocket. So any horse that I will stand in the place would be a horse that I would use on a mare of my own. And I think that is my philosophy on it. So therefore, I'm not bringing in a stallion to make a quick buck. Like, I'm not bringing in a sexy horse because it has a name and it's been kicked out of another country to make a quick buck, if you know what I mean,
yeah.
Because it wasn't good enough. So now some of the stallions won't work, don't get me wrong, but it won't be from that they didn't work already, it'll be that they won't work going forward. But hopefully in 10 years time we'll have an Emerald or a Cornet Oblinsky or something standing here, which would be fantastic for Irish breeders,
yeah.
If you know what I mean. And that is the goal now, is to try and generate a Olympic type horse that we can stand here. And if we breed it, all the better.
And because if he is extra special, even though at the moment you might sell at 6, 7, 8, at least with the stallion he can be generating some income on the side, and you can afford to hold him longer if you need to.
And if he's generating that sort of capital, why would you sell them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he's generating that, especially in the modern world when you can actually freeze them and you can have it for a lifetime, I'd like to keep him if he was that good and generating that income. I wouldn't sell him.
And it might be an unfair question, but is there of the colts that are coming up, is there one or two really standout colts that excite you, ones that we haven't seen yet?
I have a VDL horse from Yanko, Weba, and Wimka are very, very good to me. They've been very helpful in the European market and what to look for and what not to look for, and be careful of this and be careful of that, and families there that I didn't really know a whole lot about. They were very, very helpful in giving me information on that, and I've built up a very healthy relationship with them. And I have two horses from them, and I really like one called Bravour VDL.
Yeah.
I think he's a really, really, I think he could be a special horse. Very good pedigree, plenty 160 up at the top, three coming four, and I really like him.
What is it about Bravour? What do you think are his most positive traits, or what he brings to the table?
I think he's very careful and he's scopey, and he has a fantastic attitude. He has a fantastic attitude for a stallion. Andy Niles, young fella, can lead him out there. You know, he's and after covering mares and everything, he covered 30 mares, 35 mares this year, and he can still lead him out. He just has a fantastic, just a fantastic attitude about him. He wants to work. He likes working. The minute we sat up in him, he rode in a perfect shape, and he just, anything you ask him, you only have to ask him once and he does it, you know. So I think he could be exciting because he has a pedigree to match, you know.
Do you think that Good Luck will ever become publicly available to Irish breeders?
He's here on the place at the moment, and we tried him last year and his fertility wasn't good enough. We couldn't get anything in foal. We will try him again this year. He's such a special horse. And he is such a character that I would love if he worked. So, we'll try him on our own mares. We won't have any public mares because I don't want people get annoyed with you. They come once or twice or three times and they're not in full, and
then
there's money and there's things like that. So look, we'll keep trying him with our own mare, because I'd love to get an offspring of him. And if we're lucky enough to suddenly get him working, or if we find a way that we can do things that gets his fertility to an acceptable level, then we could have him for a limited number of mares. I wouldn't overload him, but would have him for a limited number of mares. And if he worked, he worked. And if he doesn't, he doesn't. And that's just the way it is. But he's happy here and he's a gentleman, and I'm delighted to have him here. So.
You're someone who's always very generous with your time. And even it's something that I've seen over the past few years, either taking calls, hosting visits, agreeing to do this interview. And you've given up a lot of your time over the years for speaking at events, and you've been a very strong supporter of the likes of the Young Breeders Program and to young breeders in general, myself included. When you were starting off, were there particular people that stood out to you that you found were very generous with their time? Obviously we've touched on your family and the key people within that. Were there people outside of your broader family that were always incredibly generous with their time or information?
I think it came back to more of, I was so lucky to have it all at my doorstep that I didn't even have, that I was learning without even knowing I was. And
osmosis,
and it was just that I met a lot of people, especially in, I got involved in the Young Breeders Group because I thought it was good to give back to people. Look at whatever they take out of it, they can take out of it, and I don't know everything, but I just thought it was nice to give it back to them. And look at, they're fantastic people running that. They're genuine, they're very hard workers, and they're very under-resourced. So I like to give back to the younger people and just work it that way, and that's what I've done the whole time. And it's I think people have got things out of it, which is good. So
no, definitely, and that's one thing that I've seen over the last however long I've been working in the horse world, the past 10 years. You're someone who you can consistently contact, get advice from, get a no-nonsense response or guidance on something, and that's very helpful, because it's not that you're someone that's sitting waiting for the phone to ring. Like, you're a very busy individual, and I think that it's very much appreciated that you give up so much of your time.
It doesn't take anything to return a phone call. You can work and be on the phone at the same time, so I am never afraid. If I don't get you now, I will get you in the next 24 hours, if you know what I mean. I definitely get back to you if somebody rings me, and I don't mind talking. It's talking about things I like, so it's so therefore it's not work, it's enjoyable most of the time. And I love people with enthusiasm, and I think the more young people we have in the industry kicking it forward, they bring new ideas, they bring new energy, they bring new everything, and that can only be good for the whole industry as a whole. And therefore I think it's worth doing. It's not that much time out of my schedule to do that, and they're very good. They give me plenty of notice and which fits in great. Like Wendy was on to me today, if you know what I mean, just about next year, about things, you know, what kind of time would if we did something, what kind of time would suit. And
so you can mentally,
and I can mentally have it planned, and she's a fantastic worker, and she does a fantastic job there.
What homebred horses are you most excited about at the moment? And we'll go with one that you currently still own and one that you no longer own.
One I no longer own is simple at the moment, is ESI Toulouse. I met Cameron in Dublin 2 years ago, and we were watching the three-year-old class, and he said Friday in 2 years' time we could be over in that arena. And I said, wow, do you think that much of him? And he said, yeah. He says, I do. He said, I think he's a special horse. So what he's done in the last couple of months has been,
he's confirmed it.
Confirmation of it. And look at touch wood, he stays sound now and everything goes he's a horse that could go forward. He loves him. So he's definitely number one at the moment. And a horse that I have here, I have a horse with Claire, E-S-I Rocky. And I think he's a special type of a horse. He's by Staccato Gold, and he's out of a mare called Clansky, who's a For Pleasure mare, jumped 160 herself. And I think he's a very, very good horse. He's a 5-year-old.
Was he in cabin in the last week or two?
Yeah, he was
last
week.
Yeah, he looked nice.
Yeah, we've just taken him nice and slow, and he's nearly 17 hands. He's a big horse. We don't want to put too much pressure on him mentally or physically until he's totally mature, so... They're doing a fantastic job with him up there now. Shane Dalton's riding him at the moment, and he's doing a fantastic job with him. And we're just taking him along. He jumped in a couple of the board classes. There was no Dublin this year, so I don't think we'd have gone qualifier anyway. I don't think we'd have tried to qualify him for the 5-year-olds.
But it's been to a lot of horses' benefit not having certain shows or added pressures onto them anyway.
So. I think so. And Horse Sport Ireland did a good job putting on new kind of classes to facilitate the younger horses that were a little bit backward
greener,
and so it's been a help.
As a breeder, has there been one standout day or a particularly proud moment since you started your sport horse program?
We won the 4-year-old in Dublin with Starstruck, and it's called after my uncle, who was
Seamus.
Important to us, Seamus, yeah, and Marion's dad and Claire's dad and Trish and Joni and Thomas. And I was in the stand the year before watching the 4-year-old class, and Dad just turned around to me and he said, "I'd love to win this class some year," because it was called after his brother. And of course, I'm a messer, and I turned around to him. I said, "I'll win it for you next year." And joking. Now, I didn't even have an idea in my head what I had for it next year. And then Greg rang me one day, Greg Broderick, who has the horse, and he said, "I think this is a very good horse." He said, "He's this and that and the other." And now he came out and he won it. So that was a. And my uncle was there, and all my brothers and sister. My sister wasn't there, sorry, but she's in America. But all my brothers were there, and it was a. It was a nice day now.
And I did wonder if that was going to be the moment, because there's a lovely picture as well of all of you in the arena, and it is such a lovely moment. The fact that so many of you are actually there to witness it. A horse he had bred.
No,
a trophy named after your uncle. It was a special moment.
Yeah, no, I think little things like that. When you have things become more special when you have your family around you, if you know what I mean. And most of them are involved in horses in some way, if you know what I mean. So they all have an appreciation of how difficult it is to get to Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Not to talk of win it.
Yeah.
Win anything there. It's difficult. It's an honour to get to Dublin, not to talk of win something there. So it's good.
That was great.
A good day. Yeah.
Before I get on to the final question, you are intending on announcing a new addition to the stallion roster. Would you mind talking us through who it is?
Yeah. I'll tell you a little bit about him first and then I'll announce him. He's
great suspense.
Yeah.
For anyone listening, I genuinely don't know who it is. Already I resisted asking.
The one thing I like is a pedigree in a stallion, if you know what I mean. And this horse, no matter what he's done, his mother jumped 160, his two brothers jumped 160. So that to me means his genetics are very, very good, which is a huge advantage, rather than the horse that just has come from nowhere, has nothing in the first three dams. And I think they're as important in the mare line as the stallion line. I think a pedigree is important both ends of the spectrum. So from that point of view, I was very happy. And then he's sound, he will continue jumping, he will come to me for the breeding season and then he will go back jumping, so he's competitive, he's blood, and he has a great mind, and he's a winner. So all those things, I think, are very important. Name is Rubens Lisilla, and I'd like to thank Dennis Lynch, who has been instrumental in this, and to Thomas and Flamina
Strauman,
who are very kindly entrusted us with such a nice horse, and hopefully we'll do them proud. But he's a lovely horse, and Dennis loves the horse, and he said he's a fighter, and he's a winner, and he's already produced 6 or 7 foals, of which 3 of them are 7-year-olds.
In Mexico or in Europe?
In Europe.
And he's Mexican, right?
Yeah, and 2 are jumping 145. And 1 of them is a broodmare. So that's 2 out of 3, and 1 of them didn't jump. And then he has 4 or 5 foals, which I saw, which look really, really nice. So the whole package just tied together, and I think it's a fantastic opportunity for us.
Definitely, for everybody.
And hopefully for the country as well. And he's a horse I'd use. Again, I'm not bringing him in to make a quick buck. I'm bringing him in to cover them. The horses we used last year, we got Wesley Newlands was kind enough to give us Hos Doe, and I have 8 mares in foal to Hos Doe of my own, including some very, very good mares, 160 mares.
Yeah.
And I think he will suit the Irish market. And Harry Smolders has been in contact with the owner wanting to stand him, because he said the offspring are very, very good. So that's very good feedback from our point of view, which is fantastic. And again, I will use Rubens, I will use Hos Doe, I use Brevor, so I used them on my own mares as well. So if I didn't do that, I'd be hypocritical.
Yeah.
So.
And with Rubens, from what you've seen of him as an individual, I know there's only a small number of offspring, but with what you see of him, and probably from talking to Dennis, have you any specific idea in your head of the types of mares you'd like to give him? Not specific mares, but kind of a more general type on what he might suit, or what mares might suit him?
Looking at him, he has fantastic movements, very balanced, and he has loads of blood, which I think are all things that would incorporate well with the Irish mare.
Mm-hmm.
He's not over big. He's still 16.5, but he's not a monster, one of those monster stallions.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely huge blood orientation to him, which I love. And that's what drew me to him in the start, if you know what I mean.
Is he a Dollar de la Pierre?
He's by Reboso of Nelson or Rodrigo.
Sorry.
Rodrigo, who is Dollar.
Dollar, okay.
Yeah. So, but it's a lovely family now. So it's on both sides, you know. So.
Well, that's a very exciting addition. And with the graphic that Niall put out initially, there was a few of us like trying to guess who it was. And I said there was a lot of people trying to guess who it was and wondering, well, I wonder, is that the actual horse, the bottom half of him? Was that the actual horse that was used in the graphic, or is that just in to throw people off the scent? But
it's actually another Irish horse, yeah. So
okay.
it was he was picking it out. He picked out different things. So Niall's very good at that. He does all
the tormenting of us.
Well, the PR end of it, he's very good at, and he's a great help. He does a lot of he does a lot of that thing, and he takes a lot of pressure off me from that point of view. So it's fantastic.
Look, it's probably good having having a brother involved as well, and the two of you go around to different shows together, and you can bounce off each other. If you're very good at taking notes, and you usually have a magic book, but having the two of you there probably makes sure that nothing's missed.
Yeah, and it's good just to talk to somebody too, and it's good that it's good to bounce things, and it's good to get videos, and if you didn't take something, or if you missed something or anything like that. So yeah, no, it's fantastic to be able to do it off somebody that's your brother, because there's that bigger element of trust, if you can understand me. There's a bond bigger than
you're getting their opinion, and a brother as well isn't going to butter it up either.
No, we disagree. We disagree on plenty of things. Don't worry. Yeah.
Just finally, it's a question that I finish each interview with. It's, and you've done this on probably many occasions in various different forums, but what advice would you offer to a young breeder or to someone at the start of their breeding career?
Plenty of experience in this, because I've dealt with a few very enthusiastic young people. All I can do is, there's nothing wrong with 120, 130, 140, 150, 160, whatever bracket you get into of a mare, if you can understand me. There's nothing wrong with, just get the best that you can afford. And people can afford different levels of things, but do the best then after that. Be the best of your bracket. If you're the best of your bracket, then you will be successful, no matter what you do. Look, at if they can afford a 160 family, get the 160 family. If they can't, get the 150. Get the best that they can get. Like, go for the best. Don't go for two of lesser, if you know what I mean. And just then be the best at what in that bracket. You be the best of that bracket. Prepare things right. Do things right. Do the whole thing. And then you can progress. Because if you're at the best of... It's like promotion and relegation. If you're the best in the championship, you get promoted to the Premier League, you know, and you can work your way up that way. So just be the best at, be the very best that you can be at that thing, at whatever level it is, whether it's the, you can afford to get a Katusha and get in at that level, or whether you can afford to get a
granddaughter,
a great granddaughter or whatever. Yeah.